Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine, your weekly environmental news magazine show here every Thursday at 11 a.m. Henry Swayze joining me live in the studio today, and we're looking forward to another discussion with Chris Gish from Standing Trees. Speaking of trees, we're listening to a group from Maine. They are no longer together. At least Owen Marshall is no longer in the band, but he's in the band on this piece, Pine Tree Flyers, here with Smith's Reel. And the phone is going off right now, but we'll let that go. And we're going to tell you that Green Zine is brought to you by Soliflect, also by Bale, Building a Local Economy, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collaborative. We'll be right with you in just a moment. We're going to bring the Pine Tree Flyers down in the mix, and it's always great. I think Henry's been in the studio two times out of the last 3 weeks. Welcome back, Henry.
Yes, it's very weird.
What's weird? Your driveway?
Well, I've been...
You've been working at your place, probably.
I've been working at my place, yeah.
Yep.
And Jane's had family visiting, so although I like her family and would be pleased to be
That's
there.
That's a good thing to say.
Yeah, no, well, it's true.
Okay, it's good.
She has a great bunch of kids who are now nearing retirement.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're up there.
Yeah, so I've been working, coming down here, first of all, to get my driveway back under control. The person that was plowing it didn't plow it, so I had to move on and get someone who would, and that's all happened. And the other thing is that I've been tinkering on fine-tuning my solar panels that I put in, and we'll maybe get into that in the third of the show.
Yeah, yeah, and I might have a request about solar panels in that third. That'll be good. Let's catch up. And you're using, you know, all kinds of, you know, grounded screwdrivers and everything. We don't want any accidents out there.
Well, you would have had your hair standing on end if you saw what I was doing.
Yeah, well, I've been around you enough. I can imagine what it was. All right, so tell us a little bit about Chris Gish coming up again. We've had him on the show at least once before, I think.
Yeah, and Standing Trees is the organization that he is helping out with, working on. He and Zach Porter, and they just yesterday did a sit-in or complaint to at Senator Welch's office, because Senator Welch was not voting the way they thought he had planned to. So a wake-up call for Senator Welch, And we'll get into that with Chris, both that event and the bigger picture of how we're doing on roadless areas and meeting the 30 by 30 goals and why forests are important. And if he has a sense of whether we're gaining or losing in this battle, it would be good to know. I know that when I moved to Vermont, Vermont was 80% open and 20% wooded.
And this is 60 years ago. 60 years ago when you moved here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the change that's happened.
And now we're almost the flip of that. It's all young growth. It may not be managed very well. We don't have much old growth anywhere in the
Hardly
state.
Hardly any. Yeah.
and the old growth is environmentally better. But we are moving towards a wooded state. I think it's more because of the decline in agriculture and logging than it is from an intentional conversion to woodland. You need, if you're going to keep an area open, and well managed open land does sequester carbon and is stores it in the soil, but it needs to be kept in vegetative state, not allow it to go to seed and not plow it.
Mm-hmm.
So it really has to be grazing agriculture.
And you know the big difference from what you encountered in 1965 as far as only 20% forested and now kind of the flip side, like 80% forested, is there really wasn't any definitive knowledge of global warming, of climate change in 1965. So that I don't think there was talk about carbon sinks and carbon capture from natural vegetation and trees back in 1965. Well, the science has caught up certainly since the late 70s and into the 80s and Jim Hansen coming out with information about the threat of climate change. And I think that really puts a different spin on our perspective towards preserving forest land.
Certainly the general public knows so much more about it than we did back then. I was I didn't know about I knew about climate change and I knew about the CO2 problem when I moved to Vermont in 65, but I didn't know that we were going to get the amount of warming we got, because we were actually headed for glaciation at that point.
Right.
In 68, I had 30 days in a row at my farmhouse, high ground in a valley, so I was getting nighttime cooling that flowed down the slope, but I stayed below zero for 30 days. There was never an icicle that came off of a roof anywhere. It wasn't just cold, it was below zero. And we hit 30 below we hit 20 below really routinely, but we hit 30 below many of those first winters when I moved to Vermont in 65.
Yeah.
So the idea of worrying about things getting too warm hadn't really, I mean, Hansen had already testified to Congress, I think, at that point, that maybe I'm wrong, maybe that was 67 when he testified. But it was right in that time that he said, hey, we're warming the atmosphere and it's going to get warmer and warmer and warmer and there will be problems.
Yeah, definitely will be problems. Well, you know, just to stick on cold, we have had, and I've run into a bunch of, I will say, old timers, people that either have lived their entire lives in Vermont or have been here for a long time, who have been sort of almost relishing, hey, we're having an old-fashioned winter here, as far as it being cold, and some icicles have been hanging around until the last couple of days. We have another snowfall coming in tomorrow night. Another thing that I read, which I wasn't surprised about, was a rare freezing over of Lake Champlain that was noted from satellites and direct observation, and that hasn't happened in more than a decade, and apparently back in the day it happened quite often, be frozen all the way over, you could walk over to New York State. So, but this is a bit of an anomaly. This is one of those kind of fluctuations that we didn't have before where, okay, next year we might hardly get any snow. So it's not a trend.
No, I don't think it's a trend.
No, not a trend.
I expect to see Champlain freeze again, though, because we are getting much bigger weather extremes. We're ricocheting back and forth between all those things.
And you're going to get your Nordic skates out and head on over.
I have the problem that I don't trust my balance enough, and I don't particularly want to fall.
That's a hard fall.
And ice is really hard, and if you're going to, I did a lot of Nordic skating with all the gear on, and it's fun and it's beautiful, and it's something that I really am wanting to do again, and I have a sled, an old-fashioned looking sled.
A flexible flyer?
No, is a stand-up sled. This is like a...
stand-up sled.
It is like a walker.
Uh-oh.
But it is on 4-foot runner blades, and you stand on the runner blade and you kick with your other foot. And it's what's called a kick sled. And you can percolate right along, kind of like being on a scooter, but you're on ice. And they come in fancy-dancy racing styles that have no extras, but they're the one that I have, actually, you can park and sit down on if you want. Mm. So it's a way of exploring the lake, and I am sorry to say I haven't been out this year, but I intend to take advantage of. There are a lot of places on Lake Champlain where there are lovely ice plates, but a lot of times you have to walk maybe a mile over rubble before you can get to it. So, but that's all kick sledding territory, that stuff that you could
It can go over rubble pretty smoothly?
Yeah, it's a long runner.
I see. So it kind of spreads out that friction. Oh, huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Hey, I'd like to see you in action. Get a photo, a selfie of that the next time you're doing that, Henry.
I get a drone, do it right.
And put a helmet on.
Yeah. Well, skating, you definitely want a helmet. That's helmet and ice picks are the two. So if you were to go through, you have something to help pull yourself back up onto the ice.
Right. Okay. So you are listening to Green Zine, and Henry joining me, Todd, in the studio. And Henry, you have picked out a beautiful looking bird here, the yellow-rumped warbler, also known as the winter warbler.
That's why we went for him.
All right. Let's check in with that as we bring our weekly dose of bird note here on Green Zine.
This is Bird Note. Vermont field naturalist and writer Brian Pfeiffer writes today's story. It's an aster in winter, sun through the clouds, a force of nature called the yellow-rumped warbler. Discover this songbird's buttery warmth, even when life outside seems to groan or crunch or crack in the cold. By now, most warblers have migrated south, but the yellow-rumped warbler, which birders affectionately call butterbutt, is a lesson in adaptation. In winter, when most of their kin are enjoying insects in the tropics, yellow rumps are finding food across parts of the West, the southern U.S., and north into New England. With insects in short supply, the yellow rump turns to fruit, juniper, viburnums, and mountain ash. But this warbler's greatest dietary feat is that it also eats the fruits of bayberry and wax myrtle, the raw materials of folksy candles. Digesting wax takes guts, literally. To do so, it appears that yellow rumps possess elevated levels of bile salts, which aid digestion of saturated fats. The yellow rump's gastrointestinal talents probably account for its ability to inhabit a winter range farther north than its relatives. Particularly along the Atlantic coast, birders, in a day, might find butterbutts in the hundreds, abundance unlike any wintering warbler in North America. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, that was a good one. Hey, that term butterbutt, I think, could be used. We were talking about sliding around on snow and ice, that somebody who's on a black diamond and they really don't want to ski it, but they're just going to sit down and just go down that way, they could be known as a butterbutt.
Yes, I did that in my teenage years once. I got on a trail that was way too steep for me.
Right. A rare time when you were cautious, yeah.
Over my head.
Right, over your head.
Probably the fact that I was on it at all was a lack of caution. We'll jump back to kind of what's cooking in the world of the legislature and solar. We recently had Rev on.
Yeah, the head of Renewable Energy Vermont.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm spacing.
Was that Peter Sterling?
There we are, Peter Sterling.
Peter Sterling, okay.
And he just put out or Renewable Energy Vermont put out a newsletter, and it talks about the net metering in Vermont and how unfriendly Vermont is for net metering compared to other states. And it's in the show notes. I posted his letter. And he says, thankfully, Senator Ann Watson has introduced a response to Trump taking away solar. And that's S-170. And then he gives all the Senate the natural resource membership for the Senate committee and with email addresses so you can cheer them on for their work. And then a week later, Vermont Public Interest Research Group, VPIRG, on the 11th, said victory for portable solar, also called plug-and-play solar, and it went through a committee with a 29-0 vote.
Maybe Bravo.
Maybe that's the Senate because 29 is a lot for a committee. I think that might be all the senators. And so there are notes on that as well. I just want to cheer on the fact that some good things are happening in the legislature here in Vermont.
Yeah, they are. And we'll come back in the third of the show with more information. I attended a legislative meeting of the Orange County, mostly Democrats, but there was a Republican representative from Berrytown there as well. And I had a nice conversation with her after the meeting. We'll come to that. But right now, I can see that we are connected with our guests. So why don't we bring up Chris Gish from Standing Trees. Good morning, Chris. Can you hear us out there all right?
Good morning. I can hear you just fine. Hope I'm coming in well, too.
You are.
You are.
Yeah, you're coming in. It almost sounds like you're coming in on the train. The train is coming in behind us, and so be careful when you hop off the train on the way by South Royalton, Chris.
Yep. I'll be sure to jump off in South Royalton.
Okay. Hey, great to have you back on the show. Henry, fire away.
Yeah. So you people just flexed your muscle for the senator Welch. How did that go? And what were you complaining about?
Yeah, what led up to that that protest yesterday, Chris? I'm really curious.
It's been many months in the making, in a sense, sadly. But yesterday, yeah, we Standing Trees, along with our allies at 350 Vermont and the Climate Action Collective, which is a student-run organization that kind of brings together students from some of the colleges near Burlington. We gathered outside Senator Welch's office in Burlington to call on him to vote no on the Fix Our Forests Act. And the lead-up to this was that the Fix Our Forests Act is a really dangerous bill. You know, if it's called the Fix Our Forests Act, it's probably not going to fix the forest. And I could go more into depth about the bill itself, but last summer, many hundreds of people, including hundreds of our members, people in the Standing Trees community, contacted Senator Welch and asked him to please vote no on this bill. He sent a letter in response, a form letter that anybody who contacted him probably got, and it said he can't support the bill as written. And then a few months later, he turned around and voted for the bill and helped to vote it out of committee along with every other Republican on the Senate Ag Committee. So now this bill is kind of only one or two steps away from being passed. It could be before the full Senate now at any time. So we were gathering there to tell the truth about what Welch has been up to and call on him to fix his vote this time around if he does get a chance to vote on again in the full Senate.
Can I ask, Chris, how many members are on that Senate Ag Committee when you say that he changed his mind and voted? I mean, was it a close vote, or was his a swing vote, or do you know?
He was not. It was not a particularly close vote, sadly, but he could be a swing vote in the full Senate.
I see.
And that's what we're looking at. I think there's 23 members of the committee, and 18 voted for it, 5 against it. So some of the maybe more principled Democrats that you might be familiar with if you follow national politics, but Cory Booker, Dick Durbin, people like that are all on the committee, and they voted against it.
So as well as, give us a quick overview of what this
what the Trump, bill says. How he's going to fix our forest. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's a dysphemism for sure, a euphemism, but worse. And basically what this bill does is, under the pretext of fire danger to communities, it guts core environmental laws. It cuts the community out of, cuts the public out of having an input on what happens on our public lands, and it makes legal accountability after the fact basically impossible. And the bill was rushed through the House of Representatives after the LA fires, with basically, it didn't even have a committee process. It just went straight to the floor and was voted on. And in that moment, legislators of all parties, you know, they needed to look like they were doing something for the devastation happening in LA, which is really real. And I don't want to minimize what happened there, but what happened in LA and all of the most devastating fires that our country has witnessed lately has nothing to do with public forests. These are urban fires that are based on our land use and our settlement patterns in town. And people have been warning about the risks of these for decades, and they were blown off by, you know, among other things, the real estate industry and the cities and all these things who had interest to the contrary. But it has nothing to do with our public forests or the fact that we're not logging them enough. But somehow this has been spun to make and fix our forests. What it would do in a nutshell is make it easier to log public land, and it's all under the pretext of wildfire risk reduction. And the science doesn't back that up. And then all the things it would enable really have nothing to do with that. But that's the pretext. And then its function is to gut environmental laws and make the public much less able to have a say in what happens on our public lands.
So if we look at it from the too much regulation isn't necessarily a good thing side.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, for instance, wind in Vermont is pretty much barred from happening because mm-hmm. of the sound standard that a windmill can make no more than a very quiet whisper, and that rule was brought on by a small group of people who were pushing back against wind, mostly because they didn't like seeing wind, and they and they got a bill in with very low standards, very strict standards that made it so that you can't build it, not unless you own an enormous area around it. So environmentalism can be can block all action. Any sense of how you come to a reasonable compromise between the two, and instead of taking all the regulations out? I mean, I know Trump stated that he just thinks that we should be mining natural resources, whether it's oil or forests or whatever. We should be just scooping that up and the heck with the consequences. How do we did Senator Welch, have you had any personal conversation with him to know, or a statement from his office as to what it is that he sees as the blended average that has to happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been in conversation with Senator Welch and other, I know my coworker Zach and plenty of other organizations we work with have as well. I've never talked to the senator himself about this, but I've met with his staff twice.
Yeah.
And they're definitely hearing from us. And I guess I can't fully speak to what the senator's thinking, but I think you raise a good point. And as far as like regulations and what they allow and what they don't, I would say the baseline to have any kind of like a sensible compromise or being able to meet human needs while also protecting the natural spaces and the ecosystems that are ultimately all our life support and was what keeping us all alive every day, and they're irreplaceable. I think the only way to approach some kind of reasonable way to handle that is with as much public input as possible. And so that scientists can weigh in, so that tribes can weigh in, so that all of us can weigh in and say, hey, like, I know this area really well. This doesn't make sense. And that's the opposite direction we're going in. And then specifically with federal forests, which is what this law would deal with, we already see the Forest Service and the BLM basically being able to move ahead with every project they want to do, almost every project. And 85% of Forest Service projects are already what are called categorical exclusions. So that's when the Forest Service says, oh, these are excluded from detailed environmental review. We don't even have to do an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement about it. Like, they're just saying it won't have significant effects, and that's about it. And that's already, they're already doing this every day. And I've been in DC alongside former Forest Service employees who are really clear in saying that the burden to doing any community protection work, or the roadblock to doing any community protection work about related to wildfire, is not a regulatory burden. It's the fact that the Forest Service is understaffed and can't plan and implement these projects, which the Fix Our Forest Act does nothing to address the actual issues in that regard. It just kind of, it misrepresents the problem. And there is like, there are luckily in this moment still some regulatory speed bumps to just massive large-scale logging projects in some of the last intact forests we have. And that's what this bill is seeking to take away. So I'd say as far as a compromise, I think the current status, we've seen laws like NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, get a little bit eroded over the last few decades, more than a little bit.
Oh, yeah, like definitely.
Kind of major Supreme Court decision last year, 7 counties that really undercut the ability of people like you and I to be able to hold an agency accountable in court under NEPA. And we've seen these laws, they're already under attack. So I'd say the balance has already swung a little too far towards
right
permissiveness for many things. And this is going to make it a lot worse. But, and then the, like something like wind in Vermont, I think we, and beyond that, you can talk about offshore wind on a national level or something like that. We've seen some of these industries and organizations weaponize some of the same processes that they rail against. And the Trump administration is trying to tighten up permitting and make it much harder for renewable energy projects at the same time as it's open season for the timber industry and the fossil fuel industry and the mining industry on public land. So
that's
what we're up against right now.
Yeah, the court rulings against Trump's effort to just stop some major offshore wind projects have been, he's pretty much lost every one. And their argument, which was specious to begin with, and that's what the judges have decided, was that it was a national security issue. That apparently didn't carry a whole lot of credibility. Hey, do you think, and I'm not trying to think like a politician, but I'm just wondering if Peter Welch ever were to give you a direct response on why he changed his position, has the language of the bill from when he wrote and said, I will not support this bill as written, have there been tweaks to the bill where someone could fall back and say, well, it's a different bill now than the one I spoke about earlier?
I can't actually speak to how, from the date he wrote that letter to when he voted on it, it might have changed slightly, but not in any substantive way. And the bill, I think it was more, and this is exactly what I gathered from his staff. We met with them after he voted for FOFA. And this is what his staff said. They were pointing to changes between the House version and the Senate version. And the House version has some, it's really just non-performative flowery language, but it has a lot of little clauses added in that says, oh, the agencies could only use these emergency authorities, which all of FOFA is about designating these, saying there's an emergency on national forests, and because of that, we can kind of set aside environmental laws and et cetera. And it's saying we can only use these emergency authorities in accordance with the forest plan or in accordance with other laws or in accordance with the Healthy Forest Restoration Act of 2003 or things like that. But when you like actually follow the statute and go read further, it's totally meaningless and it has no teeth on it, or it doesn't actually limit in any, you know, substantive or binding way what an agency could do under the Fix Our Forest Act. But that's what Welch's office seems to be hanging their hat on as far as how the bill has changed. It sounds a little better, but when you look at how it actually functions, it hasn't changed.
Okay, so let's step back and ask the question in Vermont, if you have an answer for this, how are we doing on the 30 by 30 goal
of conserving lands,
having 30% of the land in conservation, in locked up some way that we aren't going to lose it back to development or clear cutting or whatever.
Yeah. Well, according to the official inventory that was done, so you're referring to a 2023 law that was passed, Act 59.
Yeah.
And according to the first thing that Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, which was kind of, it's this like quasi-public body that was tasked with executing parts of the law. The first thing they did was an inventory. And according to that inventory, I believe 27% of Vermont is conserved towards that 30% goal. So we're most of the way there, but we're really far from some of the goals. Like within that, those goals in Act 59, there's a goal to have at least 9 or 10% of the state as an ecological reserve. So that's the most strict level of conservation where natural processes can actually prevail. And right now Vermont's at less than 4% ecological reserves. And some of the land that's counted in that less than 4 is not even very durably protected. So we have a long way to go. So we might be close to the 30% in total, but we have a long way to go for some of these other aspects within that, especially protecting our most
right. So
passing the most strict and durable protections.
So explain that those percentages again for the strict the
ecologically sensitive areas.
And on that,
I think what Henry's looking for, and I am as well, that ideally when we reached, whether it was 30-30 or it's a little bit behind schedule, as most things are, that 10% of that would be, in other words, a third of that 30% would be in those ecologically sensitive areas. Are we getting that right?
Yeah, I was talking about ecological reserves.
Reserves
is the term that's used in Vermont conservation design, which is referenced in Act 59. It's like it's a bunch of stepping stones to get there, and there's no timeline that they set for this 9 to 10% goal. 9 to 10% of Vermont protected as ecological reserve, but that's in Vermont conservation design, and then Act 59 says we're going to be guided by the standard set in Vermont conservation design. So that's what we're working towards. And we're close to our total amount, but the vast majority of conserved land in Vermont it's still open to human uses, which in many cases makes sense. But there's places we need to set aside and let nature fully prevail. And I think that's a missing point from some of the mainstream conversations right now about the 30 by 30.
Any thought of how we get there?
Definitely. I think from Standing Tree's perspective on so many levels, but starting with just the practical, I think we need to think more about protecting more public lands as ecological reserves. These are places that the public already owns. They don't cost a dime to acquire at this point, and we can just change how we manage them. So rather than the state or the federal government administering more timber harvest on these lands, which by and large just lose taxpayers' money overall, it costs a lot more to administer them than it does that the state or the Forest Service gets in receipts, we could manage these places as ecological reserves. And I think and that could be done tomorrow. And so I think that has to be a backbone to get closer to the ecological reserves. And then in combination with private conservation, protecting some of these rare natural communities that are found outside of our big blocks of public land is also going to be part of it. But I don't think it's practical to think that we're going to get all the way to those goals just with kind of here and there private lands conservation. So it'll be a blend of those two, but I don't think we can overlook public lands.
So I want to distinguish, or maybe it's the same when you say the private lands. So I've heard, I think there's even a bill or an effort in the legislature by a couple members there to have working lands be included in the 30 by 30 designation. Is that different than the private lands sector? And what do you feel about adding working lands to get to 30 by 30?
I guess it's working lands and private lands they often overlap. You know, a lot of when people say working lands, they often mean lands that are open to timber harvest or are farmed, things like that.
Yes.
And a lot of those are private lands. Also, the timberlands on our state and federal public lands would also be called working lands, I think, in that nomenclature. But I'd say right now those are definitely already included in the 30 by 30 inventory. Any land that's permanently protected from development, so from being like built up, is considered in the inventory. And right now there's discussion of also including all the current use lands in Vermont, which current use is this designation that gives you a tax preference if it taxes your land at its current value rather than its potential value if it were developed. And it's an awesome program, but it's not a durable conservation mechanism. It says nothing about how the land's going to be managed tomorrow.
And it's not permanent like a conservation easement.
Exactly.
That 10-year period is up and a new owner comes in and they say, well, I'm not going to continue current use here. I'm going to change the nature of the land. So it does seem like a rather slippery slope there.
Mm-hmm. So that's the discussion that's happening right now. And if that were to go into effect, which I don't think it will, but if current use lands were suddenly counted in the 30 by 30 inventory, then we'd already be there and there'd be no need for more conservation and we could all just pat ourselves on the back. But I don't think that's a very true story, and that's not why the 30 by 30 law was passed. It was passed to kind of set our sights a little higher and say, hey, what can we do to actually make a more ecologically functional landscape in Vermont?
So that's things like wildlife corridors that are contiguous and old growth forests that are more complex and having higher environmental quality value
Absolutely.
To it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So going forward, what's what do we have to cover?
As far as what people should keep their eyes on, there's a lot. I mean, I'd say the first thing, if now is the time, it's an amazing time to reach out to our Vermont senators and ask them to vote no on the Fix Our Forests Act. Wells is hearing from a lot of people about it, and it's time to keep the pressure on about that. And then looking forward, there's an opportunity right now to weigh in on that 30 by 30 process that we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. I think through this kind of like public engagement period goes through March 31st, and it's been kind of a Byzantine process from my perspective, but the people who are administering this process of developing a plan following this law that set these goals to conserve 30% of Vermont, they're kind of hearing that feedback that the public didn't feel really thoughtfully included, and they've been making some more space for that. So now's a great time to weigh in on that. And we haven't put out anything public about that at Standing Trees yet, but we will. And I know we're going to be focusing on just making sure that public lands and public wildlands get the consideration they're due in this plan, because right now they kind of get short shrift, and it's more like the agencies are patting themselves on the back for already having protected some places in the state. And we think a lot of these places could be protected in a stronger fashion, and that would be an amazing place to start. So we're going to be touching on that for sure. And VermontConservationPlan.com, I believe, has their draft plan. You can look through it. There's some upcoming listening sessions. And we, Standing Trees, is finalizing a listening session that we'll be hosting in Middlebury on March 18th. So that'll be an opportunity to kind of like, hopefully we can kind of demystify the process a little bit and start from way back when this law was passed and all the steps in between, let you know what's happened, where are we at now, and how you can weigh in. So that'll be happening in the next, I guess, exactly a month, almost a month.
And that will be open to the public, or do you register ahead of time?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It'll be open to the public.
Yeah, yeah. I know some people will be interested in that. So are there any bills or actions that are happening, and particularly in the House, that touch on the 30 by 30? And our local representative here for Tunbridge and Royalton is on the House Agriculture and Forestry Committee. Should people be, monitoring what's going on in that committee, or any advice as far as contacting specific committees up in Montpelier?
Yeah. Right now there is a really exciting bill that's in the House Environment Committee, and it might be up for markup soon. So they might be really sitting down to say, do we want to make any changes to this bill? And then let's vote on it. And that's the Vermont Wildlands Act. So this would kind of for the first time, make a designation where there could actually be durable ecological reserves on state lands. And then it would designate a lot of the biggest core blocks of state lands of the public forests we have that are managed by the state of Vermont and make them as wildlands or ecological reserves. And that's a really exciting, really exciting bill for a lot of reasons. First and foremost among them is just flood protection, which has been on a lot of Vermonters' minds, rightfully so, the last few years. And this would protect a lot of our headwater forests, especially in northern and central Vermont, where there's more state lands. And that bill is in the House Environment Committee. it might be moving on from there soon. So anyone contacting your state representative, regardless of what committee they're on, would be fantastic. And then John O'Brien might be seeing this bill before long, if he's in the House Ag and Forestry Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking with John about that would be really impactful.
Well, someone who I had a brief conversation with at a legislative gathering up at, we still call it Vermont Technical College, but Vermont State mm-hmm. University at Randolph Center, is Larry Satkowitz, who represents parts of towns right around Randolph, Vermont, and he does sit on that House in Environment Committee. So maybe we need to connect Larry and John O'Brien, have a little, whether they do that up under the Golden Dome or personally, that would be good. Because it's interesting that, it, as you said, it may be moving from that Environment Committee marked up and heading over to Ag and Forestry. So that's pretty good news. Maybe that bill will make it through.
Yeah, it's had a lot of good testimony, and there's some movement behind it, so we're curious to see where it makes it this year, for sure. And Larry would be a great person to talk to about the bill. He's been really tuned in about it.
Okay, we'll do that.
As far as I know. So.
Well, John's heart's in the right place. We just have to make sure he's been alerted to the to what's really up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So he's a Tunbridge. I'll be seeing him in the next week or two. So
okay. You get after him, Henry.
I'll get after him.
In a nice way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the Vermont Wildlands Act.
Yep. I didn't have that part. 276, HB 276. I got it here, Chris. We're gonna try to help out as we can here on mm-hmm. Green Zine. Hey, Chris, always great to have you on the air. And I wrote down that word that you said, which was, where did I write it down? Dysphemenious, I forget, but I have it in my phone. And it looks like it might be a future word of the week here on a different show that we do. So appreciate your vocabulary.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Sometimes it's great. I love learning new words, I guess. Dysphemism.
Dysphemism. That's it. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, I like it. Okay. Well, great to have you on. And I'm sure that as we get closer, maybe by the end of the term of the legislative session, we'll have another talk either with you or Zach or someone who's involved in all these mm-hmm. very important forestry issues here in the state and also nationally. Maybe some more letters to Peter Welch, because you think that might come up for a vote even in the next several weeks.
It could be really, and maybe not quite any day, but almost any day now. It could come up for a vote soon. So now's the time.
Okay.
Excellent.
To be in touch with Senator Welch. And this is like Vermont senators don't always find themselves in a pivotal place about national issues. But this is, you know, sadly a time when our senators are in that place, or at least Peter Welch. And it's a time where we can try to bend the arc in the right direction.
All right, let's bend away.
mm-hmm. But I really appreciate both of your engagement and thoughtful questions about all these issues.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chris. Hope to see you in person sometime soon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Todd. Thank you, Henry.
All right. Bye bye. Thanks for joining us on Green Zine.
Right. Bye.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right, Henry, where should we go from there? Wow, really informative message from Chris. And good to see that he's still involved with Standing Trees, because I was hearing from some other sources that maybe he was going to head on to another group or maybe move away. But obviously, he's still very engaged with Standing Trees, great nonprofit.
Yeah, and yes. So he's a local. He's from Sharon.
Oh, yeah. You could run to his house from here. You know, he's quite the runner. Yeah, I think he won the states in like the 20K or something years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. He could run up to your house and back, no problem. All right, Henry, are we ready to move to, you know, I want to get one thing out because I think we might really get a good discussion here about the DIY. And that is something that's a ways off, but people who have kids that are in middle school, basically 12 to 14 years old, Registration for the Green Mountain Conservation Camp is open, and this camp is put on by Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. Green Mountain Conservation Camps are happening this summer. If you are a GMCC alum or 16 or younger, consider coming back for another summer. Here's what it is, a one-week camp that are held at Lake Bomasine in Castleton and Buck Lake in Woodbury. Campers participate in hands-on learning about fish and wildlife conservation, ecology, forestry, orienteering, safe firearm and archery techniques, swimming, canoeing, fishing, and more. Wow. That sounds like a really good time. There's a whole lot more information if you get the Herald, and you should. You can find it in this week's edition. Just came out this morning on page A4. If you're pretty good with websites, I'm going to throw a bunch of letters at you. FWGMCC, FWGMCC@vermont.gov, and there's also a phone number listed here. Maybe we'll get that up in our notes. I don't know when the deadline for registering, but if you have a young ecologist in your family, 12 to 14 years old, who wants to go to that camp, you should check it out.
Okay. We will put it in the notes.
We will. I'll take a photo of it and send it to you, Henry.
All right. That'll make it really happen.
I'm just trying to be helpful.
That's a good solution.
Yeah.
Amazing how fast we can take notes with the camera in our phone. So I thought I would get back into solar and a project that I've taken on at my house. I have a somewhat unique situation that I have, that I live in an earth-bermed house. And earth-bermed houses have one of the problems that they've got soil wrapped around them on all sides, including the roof. And moisture comes out of that soil, and it's very hard to keep the moisture content in an earth-bermed house down where it should be. It creeps up and things get musty. And I run a dehumidifier in my house set for 55% humidity, which is just below that is where dust mites can't exist. And somewhere around 65 or 70, you start getting a little bit of mold and mildew issues. So I'm bailing water out of my house, but that costs electricity. And for me, it adds $40 to $50 a month onto my electric bill, which is almost doubles my bill.
Yeah.
'Cause I am pretty energy efficient otherwise. And I said, well, I don't like paying this money. And so I thought, well, if I put some, I don't care when this dehumidifier runs. If it only runs on Tuesday, Thursday, and Monday, it's okay. As long as it runs some of the time, so it takes that humidity down and keeps bailing the water out. So I thought, well, I'll put up some solar panels and make the dehumidifier run off the solar panels, and when there isn't sun, they won't run much. And when there is sun, they'll run. And so that's kind of got me started on the project. And I thought, okay, how do I do this so it is, cost effective? And one of the secrets is that when you are getting going to the Home Depot or some place and buying a solar setup, you're paying an awful lot for shipping and for having it gone through the network of sales channels to get to you. And so I started looking for inexpensive solutions. and discovered that one of them is that there are cast-off panels, that there are people who take panels off their houses because they've had a change of ownership and they don't want to have solar panels on their houses, or because they want to get more watts out of the roof area they have, so they're taking down less efficient panels and putting up more efficient panels. And so if you're willing to go and maybe take panels down.
Does this involve a 40-foot ladder, Henry?
No. It could.
It could.
Anyway, so that's one source for cheap panels. And in some cases, they're even free for taking away, especially if you were to climb up and take them off the roof. Another solution, which is the route I went to, was that developers who are putting in multi-acre solar fields for grid power, they've designed that solar field pretty carefully ahead of time, but they're buying thousands of panels, and so they're buying complete container, you know, tractor trailer loads of panels. And they buy extras because they could have a whoops and break one or two or three. Or so they land up with some surplus panels. And once the field's up and going, they perhaps don't need as many surplus. They may be going to keep some in case there's someone with a rifle deciding they're going to do damage or whatever. So they have to keep that field operational and behaving itself. But they'll frequently sell those panels, and I was able to buy brand new panels for 20 cents a nameplate watt. And so what that means is
a five definition, please.
There were 500 watt panels. They were actually not just five. They were 520 or something. And so that panel was costing me $100. And that's a big panel. That's a commercial panel. But some of the fields use smaller panels. In any case, that's a solution. So I started off behind the meter, just having this just run my dehumidifier. And I said, well, I got a lot of panel here. I put up 3,000 watts, and I have a lot of panel. So I just am in the process right now of doing a transfer switch. So I can set the house up so it runs entirely on solar, or I can flip a switch and it runs on the grid. So when I'm not at my house, I'm just going to run it on music.
No, you're all right. You're still within the just above a minute left. But
okay. Anyway, so if you're interested in this, I think it could. The plug-and-play solar is a good place to start, that the bills at the house for, because that doesn't take a lot of Rube Goldberg. But if we could get together a group, maybe we could buy a tractor-trailer load of panels.
Count me in, Henry, and I'm even willing to, as long as everything is unplugged, climb up to a reasonable height to take a couple panels off the roof, because I want to be able to connect one way, and I'm sure you could figure this out, where the solar panel is directly feeding, charging the EV. Yep.
That's what
in
I'm
real
gonna,
time.
I hope to do that this afternoon.
Oh, really? Okay, let me know how it goes. Hey, you've been listening to Green Zine with Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson. Glad to have Chris Gish from Standing Trees with us. I'm going to hold off on this discussion that you can find in the Herald about some renewable energy and where most of the local legislators feel about increasing nuclear, and I don't think any of them raised their hand. Green Zine has been brought to you today by Solaflect, also by Bale, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. Henry, great to have you in the studio, and maybe we'll see you, or at least hear from you, next week at 11 o'clock.
Yes, I think we're going to be talking about native plants.
Ooh, very good. Hey, one last note. If you're interested in owls, tomorrow night, Tunbridge Conservation Commission with a special owl program, 7 p.m. at the Tunbridge Public Library. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming right up, WFVR-LP, South Royalton.